We welcome David Maslanka to our Spokane Public Radio studios today to talk a little bit about himself, his music, and a piece of his that'll be played with the Whitworth Wind Symphony. Greetings, David Maslanka.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us today.
To
you have been at this for some time, and
yes.
You started off in New England and have gone on from there. What part did music play in the earliest part of your life?
Well, I was a clarinet player from the age of 9. I'm the third of 3 boys in the family, and my 2 brothers did music lessons and kind of dropped out. My parents weren't going to give me the music lessons until I kind of pushed for it, and so finally I was allowed. So started as a clarinetist and went through school band programs and orchestra when I was in high school. And that was the very beginning for me. Probably a formative experience was being in the Greater Boston Youth Symphony Orchestra as a clarinet player when I was a senior in high school. And that was a very powerful musical experience.
I can imagine, because school programs are oftentimes really excellent, but when you get the cream of the crop of all of the schools in an area and concentrate them in one ensemble,
yes,
it could be a really potent experience.
It was a powerful thing, and I think probably that was the experience. I still remember all that music now. I graduated from high school 56 years ago, mm-hmm. and I have all that music still resonating in my heart. We did the Verdi Stabat Mater. We did the Prelude to the Third Act of Meistersinger. We did Sibelius Violin Concerto, pieces of that sort, and that music is still very powerfully present
mm-hmm,
to me.
Mm-hmm. And it's all part of your formation, of course, and all part of the information that stays with you makes for your compositional style. If you had to pin down, and this is unfair, I realize, but if you had to give a good rough definition, at least, of your approach to music, your thoughts of it. We live in a very mixed age in terms of what's being written.
We do. There is no mainstream. What has always been my path is a real interest in the roots of our musical language, and so a real interest in old music. And I grew up in the middle of the 20th century when in modern composition, the old music was being literally cast aside, composers saying that we don't listen to this old music anymore. It no longer influences how we think about music. And a whole vast array of intellectual activity, a new idea, various other ways of going about music sprang up. In the midst of that, I always had the need to write a melody, and I always had the need to feel deeply the roots of language. And so I have in my graduate study 4 years altogether, actually, a study of counterpoint. And this is of the 16th century sacred and secular styles and the 18th century counterpoint styles. And these were a profound influence on me.
You continued your studies after you graduated from the Oberlin Conservatory and spent a year in Salzburg.
That's correct.
In Mozarteum. Yes. How did that inform who you became as composer?
Huge. To be in that musical atmosphere, I was able to perform as a clarinetist with the Salzburg Chamber Choir, Chamber Orchestra. We did a performance of the Mozart Requiem in Salzburg. I sang in an opera chorus. Dietrich Fischer the Disco was the star of that particular opera. It was a Verdi Macbeth. so I got to be on stage with the great man and saw any number of musical things. And we traveled, of course, to Vienna and other places and saw all kinds of, not only the general culture, but much, much music. So that was probably the turning point in my dedication to the idea of being a composer.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly well-rounded, doesn't even begin to describe your preparation for this, because there are so many aspects of it, including your stay in Europe, which is not something that every composer gets to do.
That's true. Yes, I've had a lot of, there's been a lot of stuff, yes.
From just our brief conversation so far, and your background, it seems as though you have a very open, welcoming, and Catholic small c approach to composition. Because if you look at the list of your compositions, there's hardly a genre that you have not touched
on. That's correct, yeah.
But you keep coming back to composing for wind instruments.
True enough,
as being
yes.
the core of your compositional activity. Now, is this largely because of your background as a woodwind player, or is there another part of your experience that?
Well, I think that there is a matter of fate in it, of discovering the thing which is most powerfully moving in oneself. I was a clarinet player. I played in bands all my life. When I was at Oberlin Conservatory, I played in the wind ensemble. I did some orchestra, but I was a wind ensemble player. I began to hear music for winds at that time, the Stravinsky Symphonies of Wind Instruments, for instance, as a piece. Music of Edgard Varèse, a piece called Deserts, for wind ensemble and electronic media. And surprised and intrigued by that music. When I went to graduate school, I studied with at Michigan State with H. Owen Reed, who had written one of the early full symphonies for wind instruments, a piece called La Fiesta Mexicana, and that piece is still very prominent today. So I had the models of this music in front of me. I did a normal graduate study, writing orchestral music as a final project, but when I got out onto my own, the very first large piece that I wanted to write was a concerto for piano and wind instruments. And there was no commission, no performance forthcoming, but that was what I wanted to write, and that's where I started. That piece, after 3 years of trying, was given its first performance by the Eastman Wind Ensemble, which is probably the preeminent wind ensemble in the country. And its conductor was Frederick Fennell at that time. And if anybody knows anything about wind band, Fennell is one of the gods of the wind band world.
Legend he is,
yes.
For sure.
And so that was my first entrance into the wind world. From his recommendation, I sent the music to a man named John Painter at Northwestern University. And Painter was probably the chief figure in wind conducting at that time. And he took up the piece. He then commissioned me to write a work. And I remember the conversation. He asked me for a piece for wind ensemble, which was the equivalent of the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. This was his request.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, sure, I can do that. And the result was the piece that you have that recording of there, of the Child's Garden of Dreams.
Thank you.
Is it fair to say that you have almost as much of a fascination with words as you do with music? And the reason why I ask that is that from, I am not anything of an expert or even terribly knowledgeable about the totality of your repertoire, but certainly there are a couple of pieces that stand out in my mind. And one is the Child's Garden of Dreams because of the source of that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe
that? Okay. Well, that question about the fascination with words, I think that exists, and I can even talk about that then slightly further on. I actually don't read a whole lot about music. I'm not interested. I do read everything else, particularly engaged in reading history and in psychology. And issues of religion as well. In the late 1970s, was recommended to read the book by Carl Jung called Man and His Symbols. Now, Jung was one of the leaders associated with Sigmund Freud at the beginning of the 20th century in a first exposition, if you will, of ideas about the deep unconscious. And he referred to this, the archetypal level that all human beings carry. And this book had in it, fairly early on in the book, a reference to a series of 12 dreams. These were dreams of a child who was 10 years old at the time, 10 or 11. She had these extremely odd dreams, and she wrote them down and made them into a booklet that she gave to her father as a present. Her father was acquainted with Jung, took these strange dreams to Jung. Jung was very troubled by them because they were the dreams of a person at the end of a life and not at the beginning. And they were indeed preparatory visions, as it were, for that translation from this life to the next. And so they were very brief dreams. And then, for instance, the very first one that I chose to use musically says simply this: "There is a desert on the moon. And the dreamer sinks so deeply into the ground that she reaches hell." The second one, a drunken woman, falls into the water and comes out renewed and sober. These are dreams of a child. Within a year, she had died. So there's a fascination for me with the implications of that, and that there is a source deep within us which is different than our conscious minds, different than our personal unconscious, and arising from what Jung would describe as the archetypal level. And that, in my understanding of it now, is a universal. So my whole life has been about finding my own conscious access into what I could describe as the universal underpinning of what we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating stuff as you begin to... I mean, a lot of us were introduced to this whole area of thought through the work of Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
And it is just a very, very compelling and most intriguing area. And it is a foundation stone of this piece.
That's correct.
Thank you. You are in Spokane to advise, or at least to hear, to advise, and to share with the Whitworth Wind Symphony, because they're going to be playing a piece of yours.
That's correct.
And tell us a little bit about that piece that they'll be playing.
All right. This piece is my fourth symphony. There are now 10 symphonies, so survived number 9 and I'm working on number 10. Number 4 was composed in 1993, first performed in 1994 by the University of Texas at Austin Wind Ensemble. This piece has become probably my most popular large work. It has had hundreds of performances around the world. It is a single movement piece, 27 minutes long. I was surprised maybe 2 years ago to receive the information from my publisher that the piece had been performed something like 30 times in that year.
Which, in a footnote, is a marvel these days. I mean, there is so much music being written that enjoys one performance.
Correct.
And then it just sort of fades into the ether.
Yes.
So it's... I am assuming, again, not having heard this piece myself, which I need to school myself in now, but I assume that there is something that must be deeply communicative about it for it to have.
There is. It is a piece which finally has a very profound shaking quality about it. That is, it touches very deeply, and it's very compelling. It's a piece which pulls everything along with it as it moves. So, to say something about the piece, composing is not by any rules, and it is not, for me, an intellectual exercise at the root. It is an exercise of opening dream space and being able to move in that dream space to interact with qualities of dream that want to come forward and to allow things to move through me. So to talk about it is sometimes difficult and inexact. And what I can say about this piece that one of the foundation points is the use of the old hymn tune called Old Hundred. And everybody will know what that melody is. And I discovered it through my own longtime interest in the life of Abraham Lincoln. In reading the Carl Sandburg Lincoln, he talks about the funeral train progressing across the country, stopping in Columbus, Ohio, and describing how the coffin is being brought out of the state house at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to be put back on the train. In the distance, a brass band was playing Old Hundred. So that was my introduction to that idea. I began to play with the melody and began to wonder, is it a really good idea to take such a famous melody and to try to incorporate it into a piece of music? And I just kept playing with it, and I made any number of variations of it. So composing can be described as elaborate playing. That's all it is. It's fooling around. Fooling around with sound.
That's a marvelous way to think about it. Using that tune, the Old Hundred tune, in your symphony, I have heard other of your music that likewise uses chorale tunes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there is one piece which uses the text. I'm not remembering if you use the chant tune or not to the Liber Me Domine from the Roman funeral liturgy.
Right. That piece is called Liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, chorale melodies have come in simply out of my interest in old music. So many years ago, not only 30 years ago, I picked up my old chorale book that I'd gotten as a college freshman and began to play and sing. And I did that because I needed something to calm me down.
Mm-hmm,
So I'd play one of the chorales, and then I would sing the soprano as I played, then sing the alto, then sing the tenor, then sing bass. And I did several of these until I simply felt better. And this became a routine for the start of my composing day, and one which I have maintained ever since. And so in the course of nearly 30 years, I have sung through every chorale, the 371 Bach chorales, over 30 times.
Are there any, this is probably an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
As you go through this enormous collection of chorales, are there particular ones that you really hope you're going to come back to soon?
They are all old friends, and some of them are more old friends than others. Okay. Yes, there are those which do stand out. The one that also shows up in addition to Old Hundred, there is one which translated is, I've translated this way, Christ who makes us holy. This is a transitional point in the symphony, and that chorale appears in a very quiet and a very beautiful way. And that melody is extremely powerful. Jesu meine Freude is another which I have used a number of times now in various compositions. Mm-hmm. Christ lag in Todesbanden, Christ in bonds of death, Sacred Head now wounded. Those.
And you also use the Liebst du Jesu,
yes.
Der Sonntier, mm-hmm. In other recompositions.
So they have been used frequently, and the way in which they're used now has been as a kind of grounding point. In the space of nearly 30 years, I've also been composing chorales in the old style, take a melody out of the book, and I've probably written 250 of these myself now.
But these are just for your own pleasure?
Just
they're
for,
not published?
Just for fun. Mm-hmm. And out of interest, like people might do Sudoku or crosswords, you know, I will write chorales. And what it has taught me is a huge amount about how to make a melody and about variation process. And that might be something that would take some unraveling to explain. But music is about variation, mm-hmm. how you move from one thing and make a coherent extension of it by the variation of the material. So these melodies have shown up now in quite a lot of my pieces. I would say that although I've thought about it much and say, well, maybe I've done that, and maybe it's time to move on, they keep coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all part of the wonderful continuum of music. There are revolutions within music, and they happen every so often, but through all, there is a continuity, and that's one of the good things and one of the parts of music that gives it its universal character.
Well, absolutely agreed, yeah.
Well, David Maslanka, thank you so much for being with us here this afternoon. We are recording this on the day that you have come to town to work with the members of the Whitworth Wind Symphony, and I'm sure they will be fascinated by your insights on the piece that they're working on.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you.
A pleasure, a pleasure.
Thank you.